Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
All right, okay. Welcome to Nature Biotechnology's First Rounders podcast. I'm the host. My name is Brady Huggett. And yeah, happy holidays, happy new year. If those things fall on your calendar, this will be released as 2020 has just begun, so happy new year. The guest today is Greg Verdine. But before we get to that, we are launching a new podcast. The podcast is called Forum. It is a look at recent advancements, recent papers published in Nature Biotechnology and elsewhere. These papers will be discussed with leading researchers in the field. I will be the host of that show, but I will not be doing all the interviewing. I'll do some, of course, but also our research team will be interviewing these researchers about these new papers. The show is going to be launched in January. Again, it is called Forum. I will drop the first one into this RSS feed. The first one will show up in your podcast app. It'll show up under the First Rounders banner as a sort of bonus. If you like it, you can then search Nature Biotechnology and Forum, and you'll find that podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts, this podcast will be there. I'm looking forward to it. It should be a good show. It's actually, I think, a better format, a better way to discuss new advancements and new papers than maybe the written word. So Forum, that's coming in January. Okay, now back to First Rounders. Greg Verdine. So Greg Verdine is a longtime professor and researcher at Harvard University. He is the current CEO of LifeMind Therapeutics and Fogg Pharma. And he's just a real leader, too, in chemical biology and has started many companies. What did we talk about? Well, we talked about Greg growing up in the Pine Barrens of New Jersey and being a piney, as he says, what that means. We talked about the accident that paralyzed his father from the neck down when Greg was quite young. We talked about how he became interested in drugging the undruggable. We talked about that. And why he, you know, he started many companies as sort of a co-founder, his IP behind them, but he is full-time CEO of LifeMind and Fogg Pharma. We talked about why he made that decision now. All that and more. So let's pick this up here. I recorded this at Fogg Pharma in a conference room. And for a while, we just sort of talked about the space and the area where the company is. They're in West Cambridge. They are not in Kendall Square. And, you know, Greg was sort of giving me the lay of the land. And let's pick it up here where we are actually looking out a window. There's a sort of like a kind of a river that runs through the area. And you can see it from these windows in the conference room. And we're sort of talking about that and the wildlife you can see there. It was a wintry day. We could see some deer. So let's pick it up there. Here it is, your First Rounders podcast with Greg Verdine. Listen up.
What's great about this place, we love it here, is it's in the city of Cambridge. That's Elwife Station right there. The T station, the biggest T station on this side. You can see downtown Boston over there,
yeah.
Right? But there's 30 acres of conservation land, and there are wildlife all over the place here. There are red-tailed hawks, there are foxes, there are coyotes, there are turkeys, and deer, and a lot of deer. So look right there. See the deer? Look down in the woods.
Yeah.
That's a deer. They're all over the place.
Wow.
I'm from New Jersey, you know, like the deer don't come out in the open in New Jersey.
No.
Somebody will shoot them. Isn't that amazing?
That's great.
Isn't that awesome? There's another one over there.
Oh, yeah.
That looks like a youngster.
Wow, so this is a nice way to spend like the lunch hour and actually watch wildlife.
Yeah.
Oh, there's one in the middle, too.
Yeah, there are like 30 or 40 of them there, and they just do their thing.
Let's get into it.
Okay.
Right, so you just mentioned something that I want to touch on. You said that you were born in Jersey, isn't that right?
Yeah. I was born in South Jersey in the Pine Barrens.
What are the Pine Barrens? This is Pine Barrens, Summers Point?
Summers Point is actually where I was born, but Summers Point is on the seashore, little south of where I was born. Where I was born is a little town called Absecon. And the Pine Barrens are an entire geographic area of sandy soil with scrub pines in it. And it has a unique culture. In fact, Anthony Bourdain did a segment on New Jersey, and he covered the Pine Barrens, talking about these kind of scruffy people who live there. It's not really an intellectual area. It's I wouldn't call it rural, but I would call it almost more like akin to Appalachia.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's
descended from Appalachians?
No. They're
just the concept.
It's an area that is geographically distinct. It's not agricultural. It's mainly focused on the sea. So a lot of people made their livelihood from clamming and fishing and stuff like that. So it's not agrarian, but it's rural.
So it's sort of, I mean, it's blue collar in that way.
That's right.
Fishermen, clamming.
Yeah. It's definitely blue collar. And that's true for the entire Pine Barrens area. There are areas closer to Atlantic City, which is the nearest large city, that have more kind of sophisticated urban folks in them. But if you look at when I was growing up, the majority of people coming through high school didn't go to college.
Yeah.
They stayed local and started repair shops and did clamming and that kind of thing.
Took over the family business maybe if it was clamming or something
like
that.
Took over the family business very frequently. Yeah. In fact, I came close to taking over my father's boat building business.
Oh, so I was wondering. So he was a boat builder.
My father owned a heavy equipment operating company. So he had backhoes and front end loaders and those kinds of things. He didn't graduate from the ninth grade. My mother, on the other hand, was an LPN, a limited, what do you call it now? A licensed practical nurse. So my dad started this construction company, and when I was 5 years old, he had a tragic accident and was paralyzed. So he was in a swimming pool. He wrenched his neck in a swimming pool, and was one of those people that you've heard about.
Dove in.
He dove in, and he wrenched his neck on something that was floating on the surface of the pool. It was poorly lit. And then he was pulled out of the pool by his arms and paralyzed from the rescue.
From the neck down?
From the neck down.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
So this very, would you say, physical person was left without a livelihood. He went away to the hospital for a year and a half, something like that, and then came home and was really looking for something to do. As a quadriplegic, so he couldn't even make things.
Yeah.
And I have three brothers, so there are four boys in my family.
Where are you in that line?
I'm third out of four.
Okay.
And we're all 2.5 years apart, something like that. So I was five. I was a little bit less than seven. When he came home. And my father then started... my older brothers by that time were, they weren't so interested in doing anything with my dad. They'd kind of become almost like wild children in that time. My mother had to work. She had to keep the family together, sell off my dad's business in order to keep the family afloat. It was really...
All right, so they're basically unsupervised is what you're telling me.
Relatively unsupervised, except for when they were in school. They were definitely supervised when they were in school.
Yeah.
So, and my dad, you know, he couldn't really supervise them either. So I was just that right age, around seven. So my father started work, having me work for him. And the first thing that we did was he bought a van and we built that van into a camper. And my father invented a lift system and I built it. He taught me how to weld. So I built this lift system and we installed it in the van so that he could, and then a steering, a system to move the accelerator pedal. Now all this is commercially available. Right. In those days, my dad had to invent it all.
But you were welding at seven?
Maybe eight by then. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. He taught me how to weld. And then, and my father would do other things. They're kind of like almost like challenges to keep him busy.
Yeah.
So he would I remember he bought a Corvair, you know, the car that Ralph Nader said was unsafe at any speed. So he bought a Corvair, had it hauled into the garage and brought me out there. And he said, you see that car out there? We're going to take the engine out of that car. We're going to take it apart. We're going to put it back together and we're going to put it back in the car. And I was just a kid. I had no idea how to do that. So my dad taught me that the key to that kind of operation was taking it apart, not putting it together.
You learn is taking it apart.
How you take it apart is the key to putting it back together. So you have to develop a system to take it apart. So he taught me reverse engineering.
Yeah.
And reverse engineering has become so important for my scientific life. You know, most new modalities, if you think about, you know, antisense or siRNA or CRISPR, antibodies, right? We don't make antibodies by immunizing a human. We figured out how they work by taking them apart, and then we put them back together. And usually now when we put them back together, we forward engineer them,
right,
get them to do something new.
Right.
With a Corvair, you couldn't do that. But there was that same kind of logic of figuring out how something works as the key to, you know, first of all, putting it back together, and then in science, you know, making it do something new.
So I want to go back. So first off, how did your parents meet? Do you know that?
My mother and father met in Atlantic City. My father was 5 years older than my mother, uh-huh. So he was already working by then. And my mother was in high school. Maybe she had just graduated from high school. I think she was 18 or 19.
Uh-huh.
They met at a dance. And, you know, the rest is history. And they're really quite different people. My mother is a Catholic. My father was not religious at all. And yet somehow they made it work and had four kids. None of my brothers went to college. They're very smart. But they're rooted in more, you know, in practical things.
Yeah. So is your father still alive?
No.
Is your mother still alive?
No.
No.
My
okay.
mother died of melanoma when she was 73. And my father, you know, quadriplegics have attenuated lifespan in general. They generally die from heart disease because they're not able to achieve enough, you know, whatever physical activity. So he died of a heart attack in January 1st, 2000, New Year's Day.
Oh, okay. Well, then you had a big chunk of your life. It's not like he passed on when you were a teenager. No.
He wasn't young. But I have to say that, so I had this odd situation. So my father would keep me home from school to work for him because he didn't really think that school was all that useful. So my mother got wind of this somehow when I was in ninth grade that my father was keeping me home from school.
She'd come home and act like you had been at school all day.
My mother came home one time unwell. She got sick. Uh-huh. And so she came home and she discovered me working on a 42-foot Chris Craft that my father had brought into the yard. After I graduated from the Corvair to rebuilding boats with my dad. So he would buy big, beautiful mahogany cabin cruiser Chris Craft boats. And we would refurbish them. We'd strip down the paint. We'd fix all the rotten planks. We'd cut the transom of the boat so my dad could get in there in a wheelchair. We'd install lifts in them. And then we'd launch the boat. So I spent my early childhood doing that kind of work with my dad. And so my mom came home one time and I was out working on a boat. And she said to my father, what's Greg doing out working on that boat out there? And my father said, oh, he didn't feel well, so I kept him home from school. And she said, well, okay, then why is he out working on a boat? Why isn't he in bed?
Yeah.
So she figured out the scam. And
so it only worked once.
Yeah. And then my mother arranged for me to go live with a family friend who was the assistant principal of my high school, which was about 40 miles away.
Because if you didn't, you were going to keep helping your dad and not go to school?
That's right.
Were you struggling in school at this point because
no,
you weren't there? You're still doing
no,
fine?
No, I was doing well in school, but I didn't do any of the kinds of extracurricular things like, you know, softball
yeah.
after school or basketball. I was completely inept in any kind of sports. I'll never forget when I finally got to college. I went to St. Joe's College, which was a basketball school.
Yeah.
So everybody had to play basketball.
Yeah.
My dorm was playing basketball. And I just had no idea whatsoever. But I had this amazing... I'm not kidding. Sometimes the other team would throw me the ball just in the hopes that I would finally hit a basket. And
you mean out of sympathy?
Out of sympathy, yeah. It was that bad. Anyway, I went to live with with this family friend, and he was an interesting guy. He was graduated from Yale and was a math teacher at my high school, and I really learned an intellectual life. I always loved to read and always did well in school, although I had never learned how to study.
Yeah.
I just didn't.
You did fine on the test because of intelligence. You didn't have work ethics behind it.
I just would do a couple of problems until I figured out what was going on, and I wouldn't do the whole homework assignment. I would just do enough to get the idea, and then I would stop there. In this experience where I went to live in, it's called Stone Harbor. It's a seashore town, right on the seashore. Absolutely wonderful. There are maybe 30 people there in the wintertime. It's
wow.
on the shore.
Wow.
People call the shore. And it was, it had a kind of a solitude that I had never really known as a kid. And
also, you're away from your brothers now for the first time, right?
I loved my brothers, but they were probably a little bit of a corrupting influence also. So I could just really live in a different world, which was really an intellectual world. My host would give me chores to do, and I would do my chores. We had Siberian Huskies, and we bred the Siberian Huskies, which was really, really interesting. To breed dogs,
mm-hmm.
So that was a little side thing.
I can't believe this. I had no idea. So, going back to your father in this accident coming home. So your mother was a nurse. He couldn't have been married to a better person for this, but he must have required care.
Yeah,
and she was the one giving the care for this.
So when my father first came home, my mother took care of him.
Yeah,
she was a nurse, but our family had no means of support.
Yeah.
So my mother, who was an absolute hero of any story having to do with me, my mother was a hero. So she went back to school while working full time and got a bachelor's degree in nursing. I'll never forget her working all day, coming home and then
staying
up late. So she got a BSN degree. So my mother wasn't, you know, she was a presence, but she wasn't around a lot. And that's one reason why no one really was asking me, did you do your homework?
Right.
Or like checking it. Maybe someone asked me, but they didn't actually.
You'd
check.
Say yes, and they wouldn't look at it.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
So then I actually became my dad's nurse. So I got my dad in and out of bed and
dressed,
help him
bathed.
Do his bathing, all that stuff. So from an early age, I mean, I didn't think there was anything, you know, when you're a kid, you just adapt to whatever the local situation is. It was an all-encompassing kind of thing. I'd work for my dad in the morning and then go to school and come home, work for my dad, put him to bed at night.
As an adult looking back at that, though, do you feel like that What's the question I want here? Do you see that it might have been a large burden on a child?
You know, it was definitely unusual. And I think, you know, I wouldn't have wished it on my children. But I look at that time with my dad as something, and my dad was also quite bitter, to be honest,
yeah.
for understandable reasons.
Yeah.
He was dealt, and my mother also dealt, a rough deck of cards. So he was kind of a rough taskmaster in a way. I think that was maybe the more difficult aspect of it. However, when I got to see, so just the amazing story. So I was going to go to work for my dad at the end of high school.
Yeah.
That was always the intention, to go back and work for my dad. I never intended to go to college, but I went to a Catholic high school and we had to take the SAT in order to graduate. You had to get 1,000 on the SAT.
To graduate.
Mm. So now it's not uncommon in Massachusetts and other states that there are minimal requirements in a standardized test, but it was unheard of then. So we had to take the SAT. So I wasn't planning on going to college, but I took the SAT and I did quite well. At that point, my high school guidance counselor, who was supposed to have been paying attention to me, I was off the radar screen. I just was off the radar. I wasn't taking AP classes. I wasn't doing any of that. I wasn't doing anything after school. So he all of a sudden said, oh my God, this guy, he should really be going to college.
I can see if he gets the scores and he says, who's Greg?
He's kind of like that. It turned out he was my history teacher, so he knew who I was. He might have noticed that I wasn't that great of a student.
Yeah.
Classically, I was mechanically unbelievable. So anyway, he contacted St. Joe's College, apparently a friend that he had there, and arranged for my materials to be sent there, unbeknownst to me.
Your scores.
My scores.
Yeah.
And,
no essay.
No essay, no. And they accepted me. And they sent me a letter in the mail that said, you've been accepted to St. Joe's College.
Thinking I didn't even apply? Did you know that the guidance counselor had done it?
As far as I recall, I didn't know anything about it. So
wow.
I thought, wow, this is really a mistake, and I'm not quite sure what to do here. But so I procrastinated in doing anything about it.
You mean like accepting?
Well, I certainly wasn't about to accept because I was sure it was a mistake.
Yeah.
That somehow my name had gotten mixed up or whatever. I didn't know anything about it. So, but then I got another letter from a judge in Atlantic City who was offering to pay for my full tuition because apparently my guidance counselor also lined up a donor to pay because my family couldn't afford to pay for it. So then I realized, okay, this is real, and got in contact with St. Joe's and went to talk to him to say what's going on and learned of this conspiracy to get me to college. So I went to college. I decided to go to college for that reason, and I wasn't sure what you do in college. So I did some nondescript kind of English major track.
Can I ask you one thing before? When you told your father you're going to college,
he was very upset.
Yeah.
So my father didn't speak to me for a couple of years after that. He felt very betrayed.
Yeah.
But then what happened was really cool. By that time, he had started working with my younger brother, who turned out to be useless or useful. I'm sorry, he turned out to be useful. My older brother, wonderful, they weren't interested in doing that kind of.
But the youngest one said, "I'll take over the business if Greg's not going to do it."
He came along and picked up, where I left off with my dad. So eventually, things got smoothed out. You have to remember, this was around the time of the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
So my father thought people go to college and he'd see them on TV and, oh, that's what they do. They protest.
Yep.
And they smoke dope. And they,
yep.
So to him, he couldn't, he thought it was avoiding real life. Anyway, I went to college, went to St. Joe's and was mainly focused on English literature. And I found it to be very frustrating that there was no room for creativity. Every angle on Huckleberry Finn had already been explored by somebody, and so you had to make something up to get it. But I loved the Jesuits at St. Joe's. They were really interesting. They're totally subversive. They were very philosophical. They were much more liberal than the students from Philadelphia who were going to St. Joe's. So the Jesuits really, they really ignited my intellectual life in a way. And when I was in high school, I took chemistry.
Yeah.
And I think maybe everybody had to take chemistry. And I liked chemistry in high school. So I was the only English major who took chemistry.
You just took it as an elective outside of your
as
major.
As an elective, that's right. And I did, when I got to the lab, I had this unbelievable organic chemistry teacher named George Nelson, whose own PhD work is in every organic chemistry textbook. It's a whole other story how he ended up at St. Joe's, but he could have been at Harvard, Columbia, Berkeley, Caltech, Stanford, you name
anywhere.
It, MIT.
Yep.
He could have been anywhere. He was a master of the universe and somehow ended up at St. Joe's, Midwestern farm boy. And he, when he saw me in the lab, he zeroed in on me and said, this guy is just unbelievably good in the lab. It's ironic that a lot of people who end up in academics as professors get there because they're preternaturally good in the lab.
Yeah.
And the first thing you do is you get out of the lab.
Right.
When you go into academics.
Right.
So anyway, this guy zeroed in on me and asked me if I would come and spend some time working in his lab. And I didn't know it at the time, but he gave me his job. He had me start doing what he had always done until that time. He had one job left in the lab. It was doing column chromatography.
Uh-huh.
And what he did was trained me to do his job, and then he stopped doing it.
And did he retire?
No, he just
did something
got
else.
Out of the lab.
Yeah.
You know, he wrote grants and at St. Joe's, this he had a large grant, a couple $1 million a year at an undergraduate institution. I had no idea how unusual this is. But anyway, I took over his job, and that got me in his lab immediate street cred. And people treated me so unbelievably with so much respect. And that launched my career in chemistry. Was just that simple. Then I switched
to... You didn't get an English degree. You got a chemistry degree,
I ended
up
getting a chemistry degree.
Happily. I mean, was
happily.
This...
I stayed a fifth year so that I could make up for the courses that I hadn't had. And I turned my grades around, too, because I found what I really should be doing. So in the lab, I was getting an A. In the lecture, I was getting a C+. Because I didn't know how to study. Or in organic chemistry, you really have to know how to study. Getting behind is really deadly.
Yep.
It's not like the course is all that difficult, really, but getting behind is really problematic. So anyway, I ended up doing quite well. I took a fifth year, and then George Nelson, my advisor, asked me if I would go with him to Princeton to meet someone. And he drove me up to Princeton, and he got an hour in the schedule of Koji Nakanishi from Columbia, who was visiting Princeton that day. And so I spent an hour meeting Koji Nakanishi, and I decided, okay, I'm going to Columbia for graduate school.
And did he felt the same?
I think he felt the same because George Nelson told him that you really have to take this guy. Yeah, he's a little unusual. He's maybe you're a little rough around the edges, but he's unbelievable in the lab. So I then went to Columbia, and I have to give some credit too to my roommate at St. Joe's had also gone to, he's a year ahead of me. His name is Tim Cook. And Tim went to Columbia a year ahead of me and worked for Ron Breslow at Columbia.
Uh-huh.
And so in a way, I was also following Tim a little bit.
Yeah, you could see the pathway a little bit.
You could see the
yeah.
pathway, and yeah. Because I was clueless. I had no idea how you navigate any of this stuff.
I mean, going from the Pine Barrens, as you say, to Philly must have been a pretty big jolt. And then to go to New York must have been, another.
So each one of those was totally a move in a direction that felt really great and exciting to me. Going from the Pine Barrens to Stone Harbor was a dramatic cultural shift from, being embedded in my family to being kind of really effectively on my own.
Yeah.
Which was really interesting, and it worked out very well for me. Then when I went to Philadelphia, it was my first time in a city. Yeah. But I was in the cloistered environment of the university. Then when I went to Columbia, that was really a cultural shift because I lived in a high-rise building, a fifth-floor walk-up with no elevator, with five roommates.
Yeah.
And they turned out to be great, and they also shepherded me. When I started at Columbia, we had to take quantum mechanics.
Uh-huh.
And I just was never very good at math, unfortunately. I was really good at practical things. I was really good at geometry.
Yeah, you would think, given your history,
you could imagine
history,
I was
right.
good at
yeah.
geometry. Yeah. So I was really good at geometry. But advanced calculus and vector mathematics and all those kinds of things, I was not very good at. So when I got to Columbia, I had to take quantum mechanics in my first year. And I'll never forget how and there was a bunch of organic chemists, and most of them had come from, I never forget, we came from MIT and Harvard and Duke, and they all knew how to do math, and I was just functionally illiterate in advanced math, and all of a sudden in quantum mechanics. So I'll never forget, they saved me, they rescued me. My classmate, one of them is Alana Shepards, who's now at Berkeley.
Yeah,
she
I
was
don't know.
In my class at Columbia, and this whole group of people banded together and said, we have to help Greg just get through this course so that he can make it.
Why do you think they did that? They just liked you?
You know what? Columbia at that time was extraordinarily collegial. It came from the faculty. Gilbert Stork, Ron Breslow, Koji Nakanishi, Nick Turow, the whole institutional ethos there was so collegial that the students felt it, and they modeled themselves in their behavior after the behavior of the faculty.
That's nice.
It's an extraordinary group of people.
Yeah. Okay. So they helped you out and
they got me through, and then after you get the organic chemistry courses, I did fine. I did well, and I learned at that time that at that point grades don't matter. You just have to pass.
Yeah.
Which I've told many graduate students since then. You will make your destiny in the lab.
Huh.
And so make sure you learn enough to be functional in the lab and to know what you're doing and learn the basics, but don't fixate on grades, fixate on learning.
But don't the grades sometimes allow you, I mean, especially going from like undergrad to graduate school, the grades are really going to be looked at unless you just have someone from your lab saying, as happened to you, you should take this person because they're really good in the lab. Yeah.
Yeah. I think in graduate school, really, grades
don't matter that
much. Don't
yeah.
matter at all. There are some faculty members who put a lot of stock in them, but if you look at, like, for example, me, a guy coming from St. Joe's, there, I shouldn't kill myself to get an A. I should. What matters is the delta, the learning curve, the
right.
trajectory
right.
of your intellectual growth, and my trajectory was whopping.
Yeah.
And so I've told a lot of students since then to, don't be disrespectful. So in other words, when you're taking a course, if you just blow it off, that's disrespectful. It's disrespectful to you, and it's disrespectful to the professors.
And the classmates, frankly.
And your classmates. So don't be disrespectful. But at the same time, don't obsess on your grade in the course. Obsess on learning what you feel you need to learn to be effective. Let's take a step back. The first thing that happened is when I was a graduate student with Nakanishi, I worked out the mechanism by which a clinically used anti-cancer drug mitomycin C, how it interacts with DNA.
Uh-huh.
It turns out that it cross-links the two strands of DNA. And with Maria Tomas at Hunter College, I isolated the cross-link adducts and solved their structures. And then it was around that time that Clark Still who before that had been a synthetic chemist, but he developed this modeling program called MacroModel. And so I did the first example of modeling what that DNA adduct looked like embedded in DNA, and then published that paper in Science. That work was very noteworthy at the time. The combination of isolation, structure-based design, solving a problem of why this is an anti-cancer drug. Well, it doesn't allow the strands of DNA to separate and then putting a molecular face on it. I was just doing what I love to do. I didn't have any grand plan or anything, but I got a call from Harvard. Basically, Yoshi Kishi from Harvard called Koji Nakanishi when I was a third-year graduate student and said, do you have anyone? We have a junior faculty position.
Oh, that's how it happened.
Available. Oh. And at that time, no junior faculty member would consider going to Harvard because no one got tenure. When I started at Harvard, the last organic chemist to get tenure from inside was R.B. Woodward 44 years earlier. So everyone looked at that job as being, not really a very attractive junior faculty job. So anyway, I thought, my God, I was too scared of Harvard to even apply as a graduate student. I just applied to Columbia. I didn't apply anywhere else.
Yeah.
So I went up. So I got a call from Yoshi, and he said, look, we have a job here. Could you put together some proposals and send us in an application? So I threw together a couple proposals and applied for a faculty job at Harvard when I was a third-year graduate student. And I got a phone call from, I think by that time it was Dave Evans, saying, would you come up and interview with us? We're interested in what you're doing. And I was doing things that had nothing really to do with chemistry. It was like understanding how enzymes do reactions on DNA.
Yep.
That was my early career, was understanding how enzymes methylate DNA. But you could see the connection to mitomycin in a way, right? It's taking it to the next step. Okay, how does an enzyme do this? But that was on the fringe of chemistry at the time. It was really the beginnings of chemical biology. So anyway, I went up to Columbia. I was scared to death. I mean, just scared to death. And I think it showed. So I went through this interview.
I mean, were you like, what do I wear? How do I shake hands? All those things,
yeah.
Right? This
and,
is Harvard.
And you know what I did? So I'll tell you. So anyway, I asked around and said, like, how do you interview? What do you do? But I just was clueless. I'm a piney,
Oh, that's the term for someone from the Pine Barrens?
Yeah,
a piney.
A piney. Okay. And I thought, why not? I have nothing to lose. I'm still a graduate student.
Yep.
So I went and did this interview, and I had a really wonderful time. I really liked the people. They treated me extremely well. And Dave Evans drove me back to my hotel after the interview, and we talked a little bit, and he said to me, we think the world of you. You've done amazing work. We think you have really great ideas, but you seem like you're not quite ready. How do you feel about that? I said, at the end of this day, I tell you, I don't feel like I'm ready. And I already had a postdoc lined up with Chris Walsh. So I said, I'd like to go and do my postdoc.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at UH1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So what they said is, we want to keep in touch with you.
Smart.
So they did. It was very fascinating the way they kept in touch with me. So Yoshikishi would call my lab at MIT and then Harvard Medical School every month. He must have had it on his calendar. Once a month, he would call me and say, how are you doing?
Are you ready yet?
What are you doing? How are you feeling about Harvard? And he just, every month, people were intimidated by him because he had a reputation of being this intellectual giant. Everyone was a little scared of Harvard. So they would they knew around the time that he called every month, and people wouldn't answer the phone because they were nervous about getting Kishi's call.
So they left it up to you to decide when you were ready.
They hadn't made me a formal offer, but they made it really clear that they were interested in me.
So at some point, he called and you said, I'm ready.
And then what happened is that the next year, after about a year working for Chris, they had an excess of graduate students in biological chemistry, and Jeremy Knowles, who's my wonderful, wonderful colleague, he couldn't take all of them. So there were four stranded graduate students who looked amazing.
Uh-huh.
And those graduate students started coming over to visit me in my lab at Harvard. By that time, Chris Walsh had moved from MIT to Harvard Medical School. They started visiting me in my lab and saying, hey, could you join Harvard so that we'll have a lab to join? Well, you know, four graduate students starting your academic career. So I talked with Harvard and they were excited to make an offer. I think I went back and re-interviewed formally. And by that time I'd grown up.
Yeah.
You know, that year was a really
big year,
pivotal
yeah.
year, for me. So then I got an offer from Harvard in December 1st, 1987, and I went to Chris. I went to two people. I went to Chris and said, hey, Chris, I have this offer from Harvard. Chris said to me, you have to take it.
Yeah.
Even though I was in his lab only a year, he said, you must take that job. I said, Chris, I'm not done what I promised you. He said, well, why don't you just finish up the stuff for me while you're over at Harvard? You can train your graduate students. So my first period at Harvard, I was actually finishing up Chris Walsh's project while I spooled up my own research effort with my own graduate students.
Those four graduate students.
Those four yeah. graduates. All four yeah. of them joined my lab.
Wow. So you started your lab already with four under your belt, and you sort of hit the ground running in a way.
Hit the ground with my feet running, exactly. Wow. And that's how I ended up at Harvard, and I started working on DNA repair of aberrantly modified DNA by oxidizing agents and methylating agents, and working out the mechanism of epigenetic methylation of DNA, which is eventually, I ended up succeeding in both of those. I figured out how enzymes repair aberrantly methylated DNA and aberrantly oxidized DNA, and I figured out how epigenetic methyltransferases transfer methyl groups to DNA. Forgive me.
You're forgiven.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about how you go from this researcher really into the translational side of things, and you know that goes from all the startups you've been associated with, and somewhere in there, you're also part of Third Rock. And I don't really know if it was, you know, which way you came at that.
Well, the way this all happened is my second year at Harvard.
George Whitesides approached me and said, there's a consulting job that's available at Merck, and I don't have the bandwidth to take it on. So they'd be interested if you could take it on to give you a try. And at that point, Merck was at the pinnacle of their power, yep. right? That was the plum consulting job
yep.
In the industry. And so I said, sure, I'll give that a try. I could sort of augment my salary a little bit. At that time, it would have been unthinkable for an assistant professor to start a company. There's no way you would get promoted.
So this is 1990?
That would have been, 88 or 89, 88, okay. somewhere around there. And so you would have been viewed as being not serious enough about yep. your academic career. People look at it differently now. They yep. recognize that having this other portion to your life is often good for your creativity in the lab. Anyway, I went and did that consulting job at Merck for a year and learned a lot from Merck. And then Manfred Weigeli from Roche plucked me, stole me from Merck, and I moved to Roche. And
As a consultant.
And I gradually started spending more and more and more time at Roche as a consultant, to where I ended up spending 30 days a year.
Oh.
And Roche was a really interesting company at that time. They would try any new technology. They're incredibly adventurous. They had really strong science, but they would get cold feet. They were working on protein-protein interactions way before anyone else. They were using NMR screening way before anyone else. They were doing high-throughput screening using robotic hype before anyone else. But in a lot of those areas, they would eventually lose their nerve. And so I saw that, and then
But what do you mean by that? You mean they would not start a trial? They would not take a molecule out of
there? The technology to a certain point where it got difficult.
And then they'd sort of give up on it.
Then they would say, well, this looks like it's going to be difficult.
Okay.
And then they would back out
yep.
of it. At that time, I couldn't say now, but I noticed that and thinking, wow, it seemed to me like they gave up just a little bit too early in a lot of these things. And then I also learned this thing called about druggability. And I learned that they bin certain targets and just say, those are undruggable. We tried. They'd taken a large number of these targets and screened them through million-member compound screens and just got nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So this was emerging picture of druggable versus undruggable targets, and it always struck me as being odd. Like, why should those be
undruggable?
Undruggable. Yep. It seems like that's just like some kind of a functional definition, but it became a kind of religion. And so I thought, okay, it's someone from academics is going to have to take on this problem, solve it. And so I started thinking about it a bit, and eventually a really terrific postdoc came to my lab, whose name is Chris Schaffmeister. He's at Temple now. And Chris had come from Bob Stroud's lab at UCSF, and he was, in a way, like a protein designer. So we thought, okay, let's begin applying some of the principles of protein design, because we know proteins can recognize these undruggable targets.
Right.
So antibodies can recognize
right.
them. So can you strip a protein down to its bare minimum? What is the bare essence of a folded protein? And that seemed to be an alpha helix. So Chris and I started working at Harvard at that time on coming up with a way to stabilize them as a way of hitting these undruggable targets. What happened in my entrepreneurial life is Roche eventually decided to reorganize all of their consultants. And I thought, maybe now would be a good time to go off and, capitalize on everything that Roche had taught me.
Yep.
To be fair to them, they taught me a lot. And so I started my first company at that time,
which Enanta.
Is Enanta.
Yeah.
And, Enanta has become a very successful company now with three clinically approved products and many more on the way, curing patients of HCV.
So that was the first company that I started, and then after that I started looking at how that world works, the academic entrepreneur, and I teamed up with AppleTree Partners, and with AppleTree Partners I founded Gloucester Pharmaceuticals, and we got a drug approved by the FDA, Romidepsin.
But when you're founding these as sort of like the founding...
As an academician.
But you're not running it. You're just sort of like you've added your IP sort of to this company.
Yeah, I added my IP. In the case of Gloucester Pharmaceuticals, I had discovered that there was a cancer drug that was being neglected. And... I knew the company that owned it was Fujisawa, and I cloned the FK506 binding protein in my early days at Harvard with Stuart. I taught Stuart Schreiber and his lab how to clone. And so I had cloned the FK506 binding protein. That was the target of Fujisawa's drug.
Yep.
So I knew the CEO of Fujisawa. They owned this drug, Romidepsin. So I approached them and said, I want to buy your drug. And I wrapped a company around it. I did that with AppleTree, and then also founded Tokai, which is another licensing company, and then Aileron, which was the first one that licensed technology from my lab. And around 2000, I started talking, using this phrase, saying drugging the undruggable. That was our mantra. We're going to drug the undruggable. Most people weren't even aware of the problem of undruggable targets, that 85% of all human proteins are undruggable.
Is that what the literature is telling you, that 85% of...
So the way to think about it is that 10%, give or take, of human proteins are extracellular.
Uh-huh.
Most of those are druggable by antibodies, right? So they're not the problem. And then about 5% of human proteins, somewhere around there, who knows, it could end up being 10%, it could... But historically, about 5%.
What, surface proteins?
Are intracellular.
Uh-huh.
So the current numbers are that estimates are somewhere around 15% of all human proteins are targetable by either monoclonal antibodies and small molecules. And so I started, really talking about this extensively, and now people routinely talk about drugging the undruggable. There are probably 50 companies that have that as their mantra, which is great. And I feel some amount of fatherly pride.
Yeah, every time you hear it, you feel that way. Yeah,
not just the phrase, but the moving our emphasis to figuring out how to bridge the gap between our knowledge of biology and actionability. That's really what's important.
Yeah.
Is saying, no, we can't just write off those targets anymore. We need to learn how to go after them.
Yeah.
So that became my life's mission eventually, and that's why I'm here today.
Yeah.
Third Rock eventually came to me, Mark Levin and the partners at Third Rock came to me and asked me, would I become an advisor to them, along with Eric Lander and Bob Langer and Charles Holmesy. We were their kind of brain trust. Uh-huh. They called it their trust. And after a year of that, doing that, then the partnership asked me and asked Charles Holmesy if we would become venture partners. So at that point, I became a venture partner at Third Rock. So that was just Mecca. And probably still is today. They had a whole process for starting companies that was systematic and thoughtful. For some people, it was a little too deliberative, but I think what they recognized that so many biotech companies got started and they spent the first year figuring out what they were going to do. So in the Third Rock model, you figure that all out before you actually launch the company. So,
yeah.
And you pressure test it. And sometimes that took 2 years. Sometimes it took 3 years. Sometimes it took 4 years. So we started 11 Bio and Warp Drive Bio. And
well, let's talk about Warp Drive, because I find this fascinating, right? So, I remember some of these things. And Warp Drive Was incubated at Third Rock for, I think, 2 years.
Yeah.
Pressure tested,
more,
as you said.
Closer to 4 years.
Whoa. Okay. So 4 years, they're in this stealth mode. Yeah. You know, they think they want to start this company. Nobody knows about it. And then they're launched with, like, I think, $125 million
That's
Series
right.
A round.
Yeah.
Which was also, at the time, new, right?
It was the biggest Series A at that time,
yeah,
for a company that didn't have an asset under development.
Exactly,
right?
So
it was an idea company.
It was an idea company. It had this great brain trust behind it. Now they had all the money in the world, it looked like, to take this thing forward.
Yeah.
And it really did shake up venture capital investing. The Third Rock model you just used, that became...
That was the biggest financing they had done for a Series
A. And it became the way that companies are made almost now.
Yeah.
If the company has been pressure treated in that way, 50, 60, 70 million is not uncommon.
That's right.
And it certainly was.
Even north of 100.
Exactly.
At that time, it was, before that, I remember when Ariad did a $45 million Series A, and that
seemed
was,
huge.
It was really huge. So,
but they did one other thing that was so interesting to me is, good Lord, look at all that money. And it's been stealth mode, I thought, for 2 years. You're telling me four. And it had Sanofi built in there as a first option to buy the company.
That's correct.
And you're thinking, okay, so now the ties between pharma and biotech are getting really tight.
Yeah.
And, the dream used to be sort of, well, I'm going to start a company. It's going to become this FIPCO one day, blah, blah, blah. And that, like, those sorts of deals took that lie away. It was almost like, well, we're building companies for pharma to buy them.
Yeah.
And the whole model sort of changed around that too.
Yeah. And MPM has really formalized that process and to some extent Atlas, but MPM in particular has a really formal process where now build to buy, where they work together with a company to build it up and sell it to
them. The dream wasn't some IPO one day and
that's
totally changed. So were you part of those negotiations?
So the way Warp Drive came about is it really was focused on undruggable targets. So at that point, all I wanted to do was undruggable targets. And I went out and asked the question, okay, is there any example of a small molecule that can drug a flat target, a topologically flat target? There were three compounds that were known to drug a flat target. Those are cyclosporin, FK506, and rapamycin. They're natural products, and all three of them work the same way. They don't bind the target on their own. The drug actually binds a protein inside of the cell, combines together with it, is integrated into its surface, so they form a composite surface, and that composite surface targets the target. So what was really interesting about that is oh my God, here is a modality that allows small molecules to drug an undruggable target. Light bulb goes off.
Right.
I thought, there must be more of these.
Yeah.
There must be more of them. Nature never does that thing once because this is so enabling. So the big idea, we kept this secret for 5 years at Warp Drive. It's an amazing story. But I had this big idea that there are more of them out there and we could search for them by genomic sequencing. So Warp Drive was started to do that. We raised $125 million to go out, sequence bacteria, and search for new members of the FK506 and rapamycin family. We're just on finally, after years and years and years, we kept this very secret. We found a whole slew of new ones, and they all drug undruggable targets. I had to go back to Harvard after running.
You were on sabbatical.
I was on sabbatical for 2 years, and I in 2015, I had to go back to Harvard. I was on loan effectively to Warp Drive. So Lawrence Reed came in to run the company.
So let me ask you, because you mentioned that you were on this 2 year sabbatical to do Warp Drive. So with Fog Pharma now, right?
Yes.
I think the question is, were you almost disappointed to go back to Harvard and leave Warp Drive? Because with Fog Pharma, and tell me where I'm wrong, you've retired from teaching to run Fog Pharma full time.
So when I went back to Harvard, I approached Harvard and said, this time I'd like to do it differently. I would really like to. I've trained myself now. Warp Drive, I actually ran the company for a couple of years. I made a lot of mistakes, but I learned how to What I mean is, in the transition from a professor to
a CEO,
you know, I had to learn that you know teamwork is really important. No, these people with PhDs are not postdocs.
Yeah,
and had to really learn how to be effective as a CEO,
as a leader.
Yeah. And in academics, we frequently value the fact that you push people off the cliff and say, you figure out how to fly. But in a company, you can't run a company that way. So I love the teamwork aspect of it. I really did. And I bit the bug, went back to Harvard and thought, okay, there's only going to be one way to make this really stick. With a lot of companies and technologies, the second time around is the charm. Think about, you know, how many different areas the second time around
is the
charm. So I thought, I really need to take more responsibility for this time. So together with David Scadden and Doug Melton, my co-chairs in stem cell and regenerative biology, by that time I had moved my department to stem cell and regenerative biology. I approached them and said, you know, I'd really like to find a way to run Fogg Pharma and take this Harvard technology, spin it out. And I'm happy to continue teaching and so on. And so they helped create a path for the first time ever in the history of Harvard for a tenured professor to continue being a tenured professor, but to also run a company. And
this is the first time.
It's the first time, to my knowledge,
wow.
And I'm pretty sure that. That's the case.
Yeah.
And the way that Harvard made that work is they said, okay, then we will require you to agree to retire in 3 years. And I also agreed not to take any more graduate students or postdocs. That wouldn't have been, even while I was at Warp Drive,
it wouldn't have been fair to them.
It wouldn't have been fair to the postdocs or the graduate students.
Yep.
And so eventually that was approved by Harvard. But by the time Harvard approved it, I had also started LifeMine. And so that this deal ultimately allowed me to run two companies and not just one.
You know, I think it says something, as we talked about, you know, you were saying earlier in the 80s, if someone was starting a company, it would have been unheard of.
Yeah.
You know, that's a full spectrum we've come now. Now they're saying, okay, we're willing to really do something we've never done before because we understand how important companies are to the research community, not only of Cambridge, but just in general, right? I mean, researchers really gotten more and more translational over the past three decades or so.
That's for sure. And now it's not at all uncommon for assistant professors to be starting companies. And it's all a question of management and balance. I think it can be really, really positive for them. And it can actually be really, really, really positive for the people in your lab, too. In my case, I've had this extraordinary opportunity to start as a pure academician doing purely curiosity-driven research and then moving into more translational research and then becoming a venture partner and then, if you want to call it investor, first I was a company founder, and then I became a founder investor, also helping venture groups look at other potential investments. And then I finally transitioned and closed that by going out and actually running these companies.
Yeah.
And that whole arc has been it's allowed me to stay fresh and to stay excited about science. What Fogg Pharma is doing, for example, we want to get to universal druggability. We want to get to where, in principle, every single human protein is druggable.
Huge.
And that's going to require an effort that integrates directed evolution to discover these starting molecules, synthetic chemistry, optimization, AI to train on learning how to get these things into cells, translational science, information science. It's this big, big multi-parameter integration across big swaths of science. And you can only do that in a startup. You can't do it in big pharma, I think, effectively. You can't do it in academics.
So this, I mean, if you're retiring from teaching in, what, 2 or 3 years now?
I did retire.
You did? You already did?
So
okay.
So I taught my last class at the end of June, and it was really bittersweet. I have to say, after I taught this last class, I started entertaining the idea that maybe I should give it again at some time in the future, and my colleagues would really love me to do that.
Yeah.
I need to take a few years and really devote myself fully.
But this is it. I mean, you could be Fog Pharma until you don't want to work anymore.
That's right. Yeah. And Life Mine.
Yeah, so, right. I'm sorry.
So,
yeah.
So, you know, along the way, we decided that a genome mine. So I have a co-founder in both companies who's Weiqing Zhou. She's our COO here in both Fog and Life Mine. So I had this incredible partnership of a business, someone who could help to, you know, run the business on the operation side so that I could really focus on, you know, overall management vision and the science as well.
I want to go back to your family for 1 second because I'm curious about this. Number one, is your brother still running the family business?
Well, it never, my father's business was kind of an informal business anyway. No, my brothers eventually, all three of them went off to be to work for the electric company. So they're linemen and dispatchers and
down in New Jersey still.
Two of them are in South Jersey in the Pine Barrens, and one of them lives in New Hampshire.
So the two that were older than you that were unsupervised for a while, I mean, did they turn out all right?
You know, none of them ever got arrested.
There you go.
And they've all built, you know, terrific families, and they're they all turned out to be really great people.
Are you guys close?
We are, we're close.
Do they look at you as this incredible outlier?
Well, I think the way they look at me, and my daughter got married recently, and so I had a chance to get together with my brothers at my daughter's wedding. I don't see them that much because I work like a maniac, and they live, you know, fairly far away from me. But whenever we see each other, it's like we're right back in the scrum. So they told me for the first time. I never realized this. They said that my mother had always shown favoritism toward me. Now I object to this completely. I don't believe this is true, but they argue it very strongly.
So they're saying your success is dependent upon your mother's favoritism, like that.
They're saying that mom always
liked
you
best.
I don't know what the right way to put it is, but like I was my mother's pet.
Yeah.
And I know why now. So in Catholic families, we often have the children have godparents, a godmother or a godfather. So I have a godfather, and my godfather is my mother's brother. Uh-huh. His name is Larry Delaney, and he ended up getting a PhD in chemical engineering. And my mother and her brother are very, very close. So I was his godson. And I think my mother decided that, like, by some odd transmission of godfather to godson, that I was going to go off and not get a PhD, but I think she thought I was going to get an MD. And I think in an odd way, I think because of that godfather relationship, that my mother decided that somehow I was the one who was kind of ordained to go off and have an academic career like her brother, my godfather.
She was right.
I had a wonderful thing really recently. My godfather and my uncle, who I love dearly, and his wife, I'm very close with them. He has been the head of the board of overseers, board of directors, I guess, for Clarkson University.
Uh-huh.
And I was recently given an honorary degree at the last graduation by Clarkson University. So I had an opportunity to sit there at graduation with my uncle and to tell a story about our grandfather, about my grandfather and my uncle's father, and to thank my uncle for his, for his being there throughout my childhood and being an influence on me, which was really... rarely do you get the opportunity to thank one of the angels in your life.
And publicly, too. I mean,
publicly.
That's nice. Yeah. I think this is the last thing I want to ask you, but I'm going to try to almost reverse engineer you on this one, but if your father was telling you that, you know, school wasn't important, what was important was learning this trade almost, you're going to help me with my business, and then you went on to kind of, you tell your students that it isn't so important that you get the A, it's important right. that you learn in the lab. Like, it's, do you sort of treat all your research almost as a trade?
Okay, so the answer to that is yes. And I'll tell you how far I've taken it. So I decided that there are many areas of science that are trades. And they're, in many ways, they're not. If you're running a DNA sequencer, that requires a high level of technical expertise. You can't be a distracted PhD scientist. You need to be a highly trained, highly observational. You need to know every noise that machine makes and whether it's the right thing or the wrong thing. You need to own it. And that's not that different in my mind from being an Irish plasterer. You know, in Boston, all of the people who skim coat houses, who mm-hmm. do plastering, they a lot of them are Irish. A lot of them underwent 4-6 years of training in Ireland in the trade. And then they ended up here in Boston. And they'll come in and they will plaster the entire interior of your house in 2 days. And it will be a work of art. They're extraordinarily skilled and they're knowledgeable. And so so a lot of science has that same element. And we have, I think, over-educated many people. And we've appreciated how important trade skills are in doing science. So let me tell you what I decided to do in recognition of that. I've fallen in love with a little town north of here called Gloucester, Massachusetts, which is, yeah. is a fishing town.
Yeah.
And I saw what was going on is that by a result of the depletion of the fish stocks, that a lot of people who had bought boats were losing their boats, and that there was nothing, that, you know, the catch limits were going down and everyone was focused on the parents and helping, trying to save them, and no one was focused on the kids. And I looked at those kids and I thought, well, they're kind of like me. They've worked with their parents since they were little. They often worked on their boats. They have a strong work ethic. They have good observational skills. And so there's an untapped group of really, potentially really valuable people there. And they've been left out to dry by circumstance. Mm-hmm. So what I decided to do was to start a nonprofit that's called Gloucester Biotechnology Academy. And I recruited David Walt, the founder of Illumina, who's now at Harvard Medical School, a very prominent scientist, entrepreneur, and also Mark Vidal, who's at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. The three of us teamed up and we got the Gloucester Biotechnology Academy up and running. And we started alongside Gloucester Marine Genomics Institute with the idea that, okay, if we're going to train these high school graduates to do technical jobs, there's no industry in Gloucester yet. We have to try to create a place for some of them to get a job. And as of this date, the academy has already graduated on the order of 55 high school graduates. And so a long-winded answer to your question is, yes, I believe a lot of the sciences are, in fact, trades and should be looked at as trades, and that the people who are doing those jobs should have the respect that a tradesman has who's at the top of their craft.
Yeah.
And they should be paid appropriately.
I can't thank you enough. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Good talk.
Thank you. Thank you.
That is the end of it. The end of the first Rounders podcast with Greg Verdine. I've been trying to find that segment, that Anthony Bourdain segment on the Pine Barrens, just sort of on YouTube, and I can't find it. But if anybody can find it, let me know where to find it. Hit us up on Twitter. Thank you for listening. If you did indeed listen all the way to the end, thanks to Greg for having me into the office and spending the time. Enjoy the talk. I always do. Human beings are so fascinating. I mean, we are just fascinating. Thank you to the Midwest Quiet for use of your music in this podcast. I should say I will gather some information and put it in our bioengineering community page about Fog Pharma, about LifeMine, about Gloucester Biotech Academy, about anything else I can think of. If you have comments on that, or this podcast, the journal, or anything else that we do, you can find us on Twitter. Our handle is at Nature Biotech. You can find me on Twitter. My handle is at Brady Huggett. A gentle reminder to be polite while we're on Twitter. Let's not use Twitter as a place to viciously attack one another. That's my PSA for the day. Okay, and up next, JP Morgan. I will be at that ridiculous, chaotic conference in San Francisco. Maybe I'll see you there. Thank you, and goodbye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.